From the Sky News Centre at 6, Leicester City players will travel to Thailand tomorrow to honour the club's owner, Wishai Siwat Hanaprava, who died in a helicopter crash. The footballers will fly out for the funeral after playing Cardiff in the Premier League. Striker Jamie Vardy says they want to pay tribute to Mr. Siwat Hanaprava and support his son, known as Top.
Been the hardest week of my life, really has. We've got the support that we need, and obviously Top himself, he knows that whatever he needs, that the lads and obviously everyone around the city as well, like you've seen, everyone's with him.
Cabinet Office Minister David Lidington claims the UK is just weeks away from a Brexit deal. But Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab has been playing the possibility down, despite hinting earlier this week that an agreement could be done by 2 weeks on Wednesday.
November 21st is the date that the chair of the Select Committee asked me to go and give evidence. So I'm confident we can get a good deal, and I'm confident with goodwill on both sides we could do that in November. But there's no magic around that date. It's the date that the chair of the Select Committee asked me to go and give evidence.
A man who murdered his estranged wife in mid-Wales and then set up a search group for her has been jailed for life. 35-year-old Christopher Carroll drank Holly Carroll's cup of tea as he cleaned up before burying her on nearby farmland. England's first shale gas has been produced in Lancashire. Fracking company Quadrilla says it's begun to see natural gas flowing to the surface from its exploration well near Blackpool. The man who sent what he claimed was anthrax to the Prime Minister has been jailed for 18 months. Vincent Potter from Mayfield in East Sussex posted a hoax letter from Gatwick in August last year. The 60-year-old suffers from schizophrenia. And former Lib Dem leader Paddy Ashdown is being treated for bladder cancer. It's emerged the 77-year-old told his colleagues 2 weeks ago. The party has wished him a speedy recovery, saying it knows he will fight this with the vigour of a person 40 years younger. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
BCFM Sports Saturday.
9 minutes past 3 o'clock.
It's been a close game. Chelsea look comfortable.
Bristol City have been very, very disappointed indeed. A very poor performance.
And here goes Calvin Williams with the Olympic torch.
Join Paul Davis and the team every Saturday from 3 p.m. on BCFM.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Ashley, Jude English, former Independent Mayor George Ferguson, and long-time member of Bristol Housing Action Movement, Ben Ritchie. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, attack on a Pittsburgh synagogue at the weekend, 11 dead, and the Native American suspect today has pleaded not guilty. And the Lion Air crash in Jakarta, Indonesia. Why did a brand new 737 airliner perform a power dive into the sea from 6,000 feet? Is that even possible? Pilots should be able to glide it down gently, even in an engine failure. Plus, the bigger picture, as promised last week. He who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. Well, if George Orwell was right, then our entire view of history could be wrong. So we listened tonight to a couple of people who would agree with George. William Stewart on wars being planned 120 years before they happen. That sounds a bit far-fetched, but he's much more interesting on the East India Company's role in the British Empire, constructing the British Empire, a private company. Also, David Livingstone on the twisting of the history of Western civilization taught, he believes, in our universities. It'd be interesting to see what Martin Summers makes of him. Martin Summers has a chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after seven. First, though, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 14 Celsius. Cloudy tomorrow with some breeze, light rain on Sunday, and also breezy on Sunday too. Next week, highs around 14, patchy rain and breezy with some sunny spells. Next weekend, it's the 10th and the 11th of November. Highs of 11 Celsius, wet, getting slowly cooler, isn't it? Wet and windy, though, next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Ashley, Jude English. Hi, Jude, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Nice to be here.
Before we hear from George Ferguson and Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action, can you just tell us what's going on at the Bear Pit? Because it's on your patch, pretty much, isn't it?
Well, it's right
on the edge of it, anyway.
It's right on the edge of Ashley, actually. It's technically in Central, which, as you'll remember, is Paul Smith and Kai Dudd. So it's got two cabinet members as its kind of councillors.
For anyone that's not absolutely clear, it's at the bottom of Gloucester Road, St James Barton Roundabout it's called, and it's quite a major intersection as people are coming in from the M32 into the city, most people anyway.
So it's kind of, some people think it is in Ashley, and I go through it a lot, and I've had quite a lot of interaction over the last 2 years since I was elected with the ins and outs. I mean, at the moment, there's a period of transformation happening. There's been quite a lot of argument behind the scenes. For several years, people will have noticed that the People's Republic of Stokes Croft have been painting and decorating and putting up various bits of public art, some of which was funded by the council and the Arts Council, and there have been traders in there. The council has, just this last week, Bristol City Council, has put a notice of eviction for all the artworks, the bear, the two goats, and the kind of stage that's there, and they've been served a notice of eviction to be out by the 31st of January. And the reason for that is that their licence is up, supposedly, and new traders have come into the Bear Pit to sell food, and the gardening will continue. So there's a kind of eviction of the artists.
Now, there's something to replace it, and that is called Bear Pit Bristol. In fact, there's a website called bearpitbristol.co.uk. Someone called Miriam Delogu, who I did actually invite to come on this evening to talk to us, but she said that she didn't feel able to speak. She'd also said that she'd had some harassment through social media or something yesterday. It would have been nice to hear from her, because she's part of this new vision for the city.
Well, it's new and it's not new. There's always been people thinking that the Bear Pit needs to change and move into a new space. And, you know, Miriam has been working there for a very long time. She was the first trader to set up, and she ran Bear Pit Social and the coffee bar that had been there for a long time. And this is part of the story. They were working as independent traders, trying to make a living in there. And to be fair, they felt that the environment wasn't really safe. They didn't feel that the artistic representation of the walls and the kind of graffiti was necessarily as good as it could be, and they
were
concerned about cleaning.
When you say safe, I mean, this is important, isn't it? We want our city to be safe. Why isn't it safe there? I mean, it's only a stone's throw from New Bridewell Police Station, for goodness sake.
I would say it's not safe because of where it is. It's a kind of very contested space, isn't it? There are a lot of hostels and rehabilitation type places around the corner. So we know it's a gathering place for lots of people who maybe have nowhere else to go during the day. And it's used as a kind of community meeting space. So you've got people existing, you know, making the day go by, and I think there's been quite a lot of drugs down there, so that's been one of the issues. There's been spice and several deaths, and I think sometimes behaviour can get, you know, fraught. And Miriam, as somebody who's been working down there in and out, has been subject to various forms of abuse, and I think it's been very difficult for them down there.
Now, I think maybe before we hear from you, George, we'll hear from Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. I mean, you're dealing with homeless people a lot, Ben, particularly in getting them somewhere to live, for example, through squatting or by using buildings just to get them a roof over their head for the evening. But what do you make of this sort of analysis we've heard from Jude of the Bear Pit, saying it's not really a safe space, something needs to be done?
Well, it depends what you want to do. The proposals that I've seen suggest that they want to completely gentrify the area and get rid of anything that would provide for anybody who's not young, middle class, and got lots of money.
Well,
and
I could corroborate that. I mean, I live near Portland Square. You can see gentrification going all around where I live, lots of new buildings going up, places that have been derelict for years being rebuilt. definitely gentrification going on that end of St Paul's, Jude.
There is gentrification going on there, and Stokescroft itself is changing quite a lot, although there's still a lot of poverty and deprivation on the streets and people in great need. One of the things that I think was a really, really big mistake of the council to make with the Bear Pit was the closing down of the toilets there. So fundamentally, there's lots of other things going on. We can talk about evicting the bear and the art, but removing those public toilets, which were a focus for people to be able to, you know, get a wash and clean and not have to defecate in the flower beds, was a really poor decision by Asher Craig, actually. So, you know, we had to close some toilets. I'm not sure we needed to close them all. And at the time, I said we shouldn't close those.
I mean, is there any possibility of reversing that? Because they're still there. We obviously need public toilets in the city. Otherwise, people are, as you say, are just going to have to go in the open somewhere.
I find it very hard to get any information about what we're going to be doing with that space. And also, I don't think there's any inclination to reverse that decision. But I do think that it's a big problem, and it has not helped the situation for all sorts of people down there. They're quite an important, you know, piece of the infrastructure.
Okay, George, you were one of the people who was involved in the whole setting up of the Bear Pit Improvement Group. What do you make of what's happened since you left office?
Well, I wasn't involved in setting it up. I was giving it permission, and I think good leadership is about giving permission for people to do stuff. Let them, give them rope in order to make things happen.
Themselves?
And it's very, no, not to hang themselves, but to be able to be creative. And I think the Bear Pit is a wonderful example of Bristol's creativity and its bolshiness and its slight anarchic view of life, and it's become an image of Bristol. And you know, I hate the fact that roundabout is absolutely dominated by cars and fumes and poor air quality, but what I love about it is that so many people see this slightly anarchic view of Bristol. They see the cube, or saw the cube with all its sayings up about the environment, about Tony Benn quotes or whatever it might be, and of course the bear, which I had the pleasure of unveiling metaphorically when I was mayor, and we had a bit of a commotion at that point. So I do feel associated with it, but I take absolutely no credit for it other than the fact that I like to give permission, and I think that's what the Bear Pit's about. But also, beyond giving permission, you've got to sometimes bang heads together, and I do think there's been some failure of the various community groups to come together with a single plan. And it should be the community that carries on with this, because it is so much part of the Stokescroft, so the Stokescroft essence of the sort of artistic quarter of central Bristol, so I think it's a shame that some of the people in the community have fallen out with each other. The council's job should be to bring them together with a common vision, not to go and impose some corporate plan on it. And I think that's what it feels like at the moment, that let's sweep away everything that's been there before, probably not because it's been associated with me, but, you know, some people say that, and let's get on with a really nice planting scheme, but a planting scheme is not enough. It's got to belong to the community. And I totally agree about the toilets. I mean, what a stupid thing to close those toilets when you could use trading in order to be able to fund their maintenance.
Ben?
Well, yes, exactly. The PRSC had a hard job. They have attempted to work as much as possible with the traders. If there are difficulties, why is the council coming down hard on the community group that's done so much to keep the whole area alive? It just seems extremely bureaucratic and dogmatic.
I was coming past through the Bear Pit yesterday and saw it looked as if it was actually open, one of the sets of toilets. Is that the council?
No, homeless people, because it's been very cold, have moved in. I went down to visit them. The toilets are perfectly adequate at the moment. They do need some work, but they could be reopened within a month or so. So there's no reason for this closure at all.
That's a kind of informal thing, though, isn't it? It's not part of any strategy. It's literally we've got an empty toilet and people have taken the opportunity to move in. Yeah? So I mean, exactly. That's good that people have got some shelter, but in some ways it's probably not part of the bigger plan of what might go on.
I mean, what do we do in a situation where the council's let us down and made a bad decision about the toilets? I mean, surely the only thing to do is for people to take this sort of thing into their own hands. And also, especially if they need a roof over their head.
There was some talk that the new traders, or there's two new traders in there at the moment, I think, aren't there? And there is talk that at some point maybe the university or somebody will invest in putting a different sort of toilet in there, like a dry toilet or a piece of innovative equipment, which will be great if that eventually happens. But we're going to have like a year or two. Everything seems to move so slowly with the council at the moment. They seem unable to get anything actually done. So that's one of the issues that I think we'll have this like impasse where nothing will happen and things will just get worse.
Ben, I was looking at, I think it was Channel 4 News or ITV News the other day, Manchester. What they've done for the cold is they've got a piece of council property. They've just basically got a load of beds in it and some washrooms and opened it up because they've got such a massive problem with rough sleeping in the city, hundreds of street homeless, that they've decided, well, we're just going to spend a little bit of money on making sure that from 9 o'clock in the evening until 9 o'clock in the morning, the homeless people have got somewhere that's out of the cold.
Well, the council do the cold weather project, or it is going on in Bristol, but they don't do enough. The problem with vast buildings and big hostels is organisation and order. And I think the real disappointment with the council is that while they talk about identifying people, self-identifying places, and they will leave them alone, they haven't in actual practice done so. They've harried the homeless.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jasper Thompson with his Help the Homeless project is a wonderful example of where you should give permission. You should encourage people like that across the city who've got a passion for the city, who have a real heart about the homeless, who are doing something practical. Because I think we've really failed to find interim solutions for the homeless. It's all very well building new homes. Absolutely right. I completely support Paul Smith and his projects for building more homes in the city. But we must be prepared to find interim solutions that are a stepping stone to new homes, because we build new homes and it doesn't get any better because it takes a long time. And so we need to work with the existing situation rather than have a perfect situation, because we'll never have the perfect.
Jude, last week we had a guy called Rich Carey on here, who was one of the squatters. They'd taken over a bit of council property on the harbour side. This they'd renovated, put electrics in, that sort of thing. And the council hadn't even noticed they'd been there for something like a year, maybe not quite so long. Ben, you can probably get a better figure. And then the council come in and evict them. Within a few weeks, the place has been burnt down, and that's a listed building gone. It doesn't seem like we've got a hands-off council, the sort of thing that George was talking about, and not really a give permission to do things council. More the opposite, almost like, well, if we haven't decided to do it, you can't do it.
Well, yes, Rich was part of the group who were camped outside the council house recently, the kind of little tented city that was there in the summer. And I know that he had great problems trying to communicate with anyone about what would happen when his band of people were moved on. And I was copied into quite a lot of the emails. And it seemed really, really difficult and traumatic for him to try and find the right person. And we didn't really have a system. I mean, I do believe we are trying to do stuff in the council, but it seems that it's not really working particularly well at the moment. I mean, in Ashley, when I cycle in to work in the morning to City Hall, around the back of the Hilton Hotel, there's at least 10 people sleeping in the little kind of alleyway behind there. So we're not really managing it very well, I don't think. Considering it's one of Marvin's key, you know, we're going to sort the homeless thing out. It was one of his key planks of the One City approach. So I'd like to, in a way, it'd be nice to have some feedback properly about how we're doing with that. It doesn't really feel like we're doing that well.
Well, we can get a bit of feedback, I suppose, from Ben. I mean, what is the general... you've been helping homeless people for decades, haven't you? I mean, what do you make of this present administration?
Well, unfortunately, they just seem to be very heavy-handed. good noises are made, but organised people have found that they're just moved on either from buildings or sites without any consideration of particularities, whether they're a good group of people or not. And there's a lot of resentment about this because when they came into power last year, there was great expectations that maybe something would happen, but it hasn't materialised at all, as far as I can see.
2.5 years ago, actually.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, George, is it just simply because homeless people have often got so many other complex issues that it's too much for whoever's in charge of the city to really deal with, or is it because they don't vote, they're not, it's out of sight, out of mind, and the city leaders don't really care?
I think there's an element of them not voting. I think most councillors, probably all councillors, care. So I don't think you can say it's a matter of not caring. I think it's a matter of just finding it too big an issue for them to be able to solve, and liking occasionally to brush it under the carpet or move it away and hope somehow it gets more out of sight. And it will never do that. You just push the problem on. So I realised that some of the people who were in the bear pit were actually quite, more than difficult, quite violent occasionally. But that, to me, seemed like an issue that needed facing head on rather than brushing away. So we needed to deal with these. Yeah, there are people with mental issues. There are people with drugs issues and alcohol issues. But we need to deal with those and embrace them rather than just push them away, because they will not go away on their own. And there are some really good people who are involved and can help. And, some of the charities we work with are absolutely brilliant.
Final word to you, Ben, on the bear pit and the homeless issue. What do you think, if you were sitting in Marvin's shoes, what would be your priorities? Two or three things, maybe, to get people out and also to give them somewhere stable that they can actually get their lives back together again.
Well, if people sensibly find themselves sites or buildings where they're no problem, leave them alone. Yeah. If you can't help, don't hinder. Secondly, if you want to deal with the bear pit, engage, as has been said before, with the communities already there. Don't expect it to be perfect with a commercial project, because it's just going to be a repetition of the bear pit. People aren't going to go away if they've got nowhere else to go. It's quite logical.
George, it doesn't seem too much to ask to leave people alone, does it? I mean, if you're in the corner of a park in a tent, and suddenly someone from the council comes along and says, "Hang on a minute, you can't be here. We need to get out of the way."
I think
else.
Leave people alone if they're not causing nuisance to others, and try and involve them in projects like Edible Bristol. Try and involve them in something that is doing good for the community. So I'm all for us growing things in Bear Pit, but let's think of that as a community project rather than as a council project.
Ben, how do people contact Bristol Housing Action? And if they know someone who's homeless, or if they're homeless themselves, is there? I know you'll say yes, there is a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, but how can they get involved in what you're up to?
Well, we have a website, telephone numbers. We regularly do outreach, and we have regular meetings. So the people who need to contact us will contact us. We're also in touch with a number of agencies. So,
but isn't squatting illegal?
Squatting is illegal in residential property at the moment, but I believe the police don't have the resources to deal with it, and I don't think they're particularly interested either, so I'm not going to say any more on that.
Okay, all right. Jude?
I was just going to mention that it's quite interesting, isn't it, that it's illegal technically in residential properties, but in empty shops, and I can think of several that I cycle past every day, it's not. And I think the council could be more creative with that little kind of, it's not a loophole, but it's an opportunity perhaps. Not that I'm saying we should do anything illegal.
I will leave a link up to Bristol Housing Action on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I'd also ask you, George, if you're in Paul Smith's shoes, I mean, he's looking at housing, but he's actually looking at building houses. He's not really looking after the homeless much. It seems to be mostly the Parks Department seem to be the people who are most involved.
Well, as I said, building houses is a long game. I mean, I started building the first council houses in Bristol for 30 years. So I'm not going to be lectured by the political parties about building of houses. I believe in social housing. I don't believe in selling social housing, which is what we do faster than we build them. And so I think Paul is absolutely on the right tack. I think we need more affordable housing mixed with student housing, more affordable housing mixed with commercial development. And so let's push in that direction. But at the same time, we've got to find interim solutions. It's not just about numbers. And actually, chasing numbers has been a mug's game. Chasing numbers means we come up with terrible solutions like building high buildings across the city, which is what the mistake we made in the 60s and 70s, and we seem to be going back to. So let's think about creating decent communities that involve everybody.
Look, I mean, with this incredibly high-value property, the obvious thing is to build up because there's just not enough space.
Yeah, but you don't get higher density by building up. You just get environment. You get higher density by building decent streets. You can build, you know, if you build a city like Barcelona, which doesn't have many high buildings in the centre of Barcelona, and yet has four times the density of the average European city, but it's based on five or six stories, as many European cities. Building high is a mug's game, a total misunderstanding of what high density is and what creates a decent community.
I just want to echo what George has said, and you know, it seems counterintuitive, but building high is very expensive, and that's why developers outside of the City of London and the Shard and all those projects that are, you know, a bit strange in some ways, building high in Bristol is really not the solution, and developers don't really want to do it.
Well, I've seen quite a lot of these plans for Spike Island, etc. There's loads of, like, tower blocks, basically. I mean, they seem to
be... You mean Bedminster Green?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's appalling. It's completely
against
the character.
You know what? Suddenly, it's almost like a penny's dropping in my head here, because we were hearing two things here. One with this vision for the Bear Pit. Another with this... Bedminster Green and Spike Island, where actually it seems that we haven't got a Labour administration, we've got a sort of Tory administration, a big business administration, and that Marvin Rees sounds to me as if he's kind of halfway between the Labour Party, I'm almost a bit of a Tony Blair maybe, between the Labour Party and the business community, George. I mean, because these big developers, they sit and they will say, well, actually, this is what we would like to do. Seems to me, Marvin, in order to get houses built, is saying yes, yes, yes to them.
You're not going to draw me into a personal attack on Marvin, because, you know, I'm sure he's a decent guy, he's trying to do the right thing, but I think I don't think he quite understands what makes a city tick. I wish he would listen more to some of the other councillors on the city council who've got some really good ideas. But he's more and more drawing in the power to himself. And I know people accuse me of that. I was an independent mayor. I didn't have a party. But I really enjoyed sharing that power, even though some people would deny this. I really enjoyed sharing that power with all the four other parties with a rainbow cabinet. They were all brilliant. They kept their party politics out of the door when we were having cabinet discussions, and it was that was such a creative process. We were promised that, and we've lost it.
Jude, what do you make of this? This is maybe my conspiracy theory here. I'm saying, well, look, both the Bear Pit and when we're talking about these high-rise developments, it seems that the mayor is doing what big business wants, not what ordinary people in the city want.
I tend to agree when I look at what the sorts of things that our mayor does, that is a kind of Tory light approach, actually. You know, I think Paul Smith is a proper Labour bloke and he understands about social housing. And I think he's probably caught between Marvin's desire to build high and Paul's quite realistic approach, which is we need to build what we need. I think Marvin's very aspirational about this idea that we'll have some high buildings, and he looks to other places like New York or London. But we are not New York or London. No. We are Bristol.
It's very
different. And I don't think he's very good at listening to other points of view.
I thought it was Beijing and Kuala Lumpur.
Well, that may be the case, but Beijing and Kuala Lumpur, if you look at the way that people are housed actually in Beijing and Kuala Lumpur in tiny little units, which is also the way we're going. I mean, the massive amount of student accommodation being built in the city as well is also kind of indicative of this. Let's move towards lots of very high density but poor quality you know, hutches for students.
I think
to
it's
live
more
in
Birmingham than Barcelona.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and it's sad. When I arrived in this city, we were trying to be Birmingham. We were building highways. We were building high blocks of flats, and I just thought, what on earth's happening? And it politicised me when I was a student, because I thought, you know, we're wrecking a lovely city. And, you know, to go back to that seems incredibly simplistic to me. It is, as Jude says, it's an aspiration, but I think it's a very misguided aspiration.
I mean, we could look for some of the developments that's happening just further up from the Bear Pit in Stokes Croft. You know, at the moment there are plans for several applications for quite high-ish buildings, but some that could be very high. People would be shocked to know quite how many stories people think they can put on the very entrance to Stokes Croft. And because we haven't got a local plan yet, and in fact the supplementary local plan is coming to Cabinet on Tuesday, it could easily be pushed through that these high buildings go through, and then developers who want to build high-ish can have a carte blanche to do it. And I think people will look back in a couple of years and go, oh my God, how did we let that happen? And the way we let it happen is by having not a rainbow cabinet, no other opinions. Marvin gets what Marvin wants, which is part of what we kind of see, you know, happening a lot, I think. I mean, the transport thing's another issue, I think, where he doesn't understand the bigger picture, and we end up in a,
hang
in
on,
a bit,
George,
of a pickle.
Because I'd just like to bring our Labour Party person who's been sitting here very politely, not quite in the corner, but anyway, Martin Summers, what do you make of this? I mean, planning is very important, isn't it? And actually, whether you're talking about your vision for the city or actually the whole, you know, the planning process, development process, and the council giving permission for things it's on a very, very loose rein at the moment.
Well, I'm not going to defend Marvin's particular decisions, because obviously I'm not competent to critique what's going on. I listen very with interest to what's been said in this conversation. I think one of the fundamental things is that local government doesn't actually have a great deal of power, and we're talking about as if Marvin is actually the maestro of Bristol. It's just not the case. I mean, developers basically have got most of the cards. They can appeal any decisions they don't like, or the councils can't appeal it. And of course, we've had this whole idea of having elected mayors at the same time as the powers of the council have been massively reduced. And of course, we talked about homelessness earlier. Really, what's pushing that to my mind is the whole rollout of universal credit, with a 5 or 6 week wait, which puts people straight into rent arrears. They're going straight to Wonga or wherever immediately. I mean, it's just stupid. And it's created, wherever it's been rolled out, it's quite clear what the implications are. Massive increase in registered homelessness. And that's just central government, you know, vandalism, basically. And I'm all in favour of insofar as you can, trying to involve the community and try and, you know, get a democratic setup inside the city. But the reality is, for most people, and I knock on doors for the Labour Party, they know very well that the council doesn't really decide things. It's all decided at central level. And that's why you've got to change the central government policy.
Jude, is that a bit of a cop-out?
No, there's elements of truth in it, of course. It is central government doing exactly what he said. But then part of my disappointment is that we don't seem to be able to be more creative and joined up with the stuff that we are trying to do. So, you know, there's kind of a lot of change in Bristol City Council over the last year, definitely. Lots of new people in position, and, you know, it feels like we're constantly waiting for the joined upness to start. So well, that's what I find frustrating.
A little bit more, or a bit less joined upness this week with the resignation of Vari Threlfall, who's in charge of transport. Now, this is coming at a time where there's a lot of, I mean, you know, we've just had the Metro bus after many years of pain, which doesn't really seem to have made very much difference at all, and the looming of a congestion charge. What do you make, Jude, of this, of Vari quitting? I mean, I tried to get a chat with, didn't want to have a chat with me, but what she's effectively saying is, I'm going to spend more time with my other job and my family, that sort of thing, and that there's no reason other than that for me to have quitted. But what interests me is that nobody's now taking her place. So Marvin Rees is going to be taking over that portfolio as the mayor and being in charge of transport as well, which makes me think, well, maybe there wasn't any real thought of succession and handing over to someone and having some sort of succession period where, you know, that would be an orderly way of doing things. We would have thought, no, she's gone and Marvin's taking over.
I've just got to kind of surmise, but, you know, if I look at what's been going on in the last few months, we've had a lot of trouble with anything moving in transport generally. I suspect that she's been highly frustrated by not being able to move forward with the suggestions that officers make about how we should move forward with congestion charges and all sorts of other things. And as a, you know, bright young person with, I think, probably a good career ahead of her in the Labour Party, she's decided to make a kind of competent decision to go and fight in the wards. And, you know, we may have an election in the next 6 months that may have something to do it, but I think she's been frustrated by her inability to get anything past her boss, and the boss has now taken control of transport, and we'll see what happens. I don't really feel very confident that good things are going to happen, and I think it's a real shame she's gone, but I can understand why she might have done it.
Well, she's given up an extra, I mean, these cabinet posts come with an extra 20 grand a year, don't they? So she's given that up, well, even though she's got another job at the University of the West of England. Anyway, before we ask George Ferguson about this latest little development and how to or how not to run your cabinet, we will hear from a guy called Max Langer at Bristol University, who started a petition about Bristol's buses.
I started a petition because a couple of weeks ago, a woman from Brislington, I believe, started up a Facebook event for a protest because she was just fed up of the service that she was getting. And I, whenever I saw that, I was, you know, fist pumping the air. I was so happy.
At last, someone's doing something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because the council haven't, the government hasn't.
So I think when it comes to that, the last thing you can do is really go out and just protest and say that this is not good enough.
Okay, I think we better say what the Facebook page is so people listening can find it.
So the event on Facebook for that protest is called the Bristol Bus Protest. And then for my petition, it's Take Control of Bristol's Buses. And that's also on Twitter and everywhere else.
OK, so you're trying to get the issue raised, which is great.
Yeah.
But what would you propose? So it's very easy to criticise. The system is as it is. How would you do it, Max?
So my petition particularly points out the idea of bus franchising, which is how buses are run in London, and it's how Manchester are hoping to improve their bus system as well. And basically what that means, bus franchising, it's not like rail franchising, there's no subsidies. It's the idea that the authority, so the West of England Combined Authority, who take control of transport, and Bristol City Council, are able to choose the routes they want to run, choose the timetables they want to be run, choose the buses that they, the kind of environmental standards that they want to be enforced, and set the fares. And then they open that up to the private market, so to First Bus, to Bristol Community Transport, to all of these different bus companies, and say, who wants to run our bus services?
Well, I thought we were doing that already here in Bristol.
No, they're able to run whatever services they want. They can cut a service with a few weeks' notice. They can amend it so that they don't, so you can see.
Actually, they can cut a service with no notice.
Yes.
They just say, sorry, no drivers.
Well, usually they give a couple of days.
Usually they send at least one bus a day along a route, don't they?
Yeah, so they have free rein. That is what the deregulation of the bus service has done. They have free rein to do what they like. What my proposal is basically saying, we will ask you to provide our services. We know what we want. You then come along and say, yes, we'll provide that service.
Well, buses, yes. I mean, this could be another reason why Vary's decided that it might be time to hand in her notice.
Well, the protest is on the 23rd of November. I'll put links to that up on our show page and to the petition.
Perhaps not directly to do with the protest, but more to do with
24th.
Frustration about not really getting any big vision or movement on how we do, you know, move forward with bus transport. I know she was actually very, very keen on sorting this out. She's a bus user herself. I know she comes in and out from Uwe on it. So there's always good ideas about how we might do stuff, but we are in the system we're in, you know. And it's a funny one, isn't it? Because, you know, in his State of the Nation talk, Marvin said flat fares are going to be helpful. But actually, the flat fare change that we've just had means that most people on short journeys are going to pay more. And First Bus is, you know, we forget, I think, that First Bus is an employee-owned company. It's actually a good company, in a way. It's been the subject of two hostile takeovers in the last year. We are in a very difficult place with buses. I think the problem would be better to sort out the congestion. The congestion in the city is actually what's killing the bus service.
But hang on, I mean, what the people are protesting about more, surely, is to do with buses simply just not being run, so having no driver to drive it. I mean, surely, if you're running a business and people need your bus to get to work, you need to have maybe a couple of extra drivers, rather than if someone takes a day off sick, then the bus doesn't run. I mean, that's a no-brainer, isn't it?
That's an interesting one, isn't it? And if you just take a look at the bigger picture, so the Greens have recently asked Marvin to let us know what the Brexit preparedness strategy is. Now, I would say it's not that hard of a thing to work out that we've got a shortage of bus drivers across the southwest. Now, we've got a shortage of nurses, we've got a shortage of all sorts of people who do, you know, really useful jobs. I suspect there's something going on here where we've not got enough bus drivers because a lot of them have left to go somewhere else.
Could it not be also because they're not being paid enough? There's not training?
I think they get paid quite a reasonable wage. If you look at how much a bus driver for first bus gets, it's not a bad job. I'm surprised there's not more people wanting to do it. But I think it's a really difficult job in the city when you are trying to drive your bus from, you know, Frenchay into town, and you're always late and people are always giving you a hard time because the congestion in the city is still so bad. The roadworks, the inability to get in and out on time, and the kind of lack of this transport strategy and plan or anything really happening is a big issue. In my ward, a little tiny road was shut, Magdalen Place, this last week, so that we can do some building, or so a developer can build. And the amount of tailback onto Ashley Hill has been tremendous. I've had so many complaints about it, and there seems to be no forward plan to think what happens when you shut a road to build all these houses that we want to build. So it's just a bit of a mess, actually.
George, congestion and buses, what do you make of this reason? Well, any ideas about why Fari's decided to jump ship?
No, what the bus protest people are talking about really is the quality contract, that we should have a quality contract. I have a lot of time for First Bus. I think that the managing director of First Bus has done an excellent job. We worked together to try and reduce fares. My deal was that I would deliver the residents' parking zones, which reduces the amount of commuter traffic being able to park in the centralish areas. I would have now been expanding that by another 8 areas. This was working in order to make the buses, the public transport, move better, to create better routes, safer routes, together with 20 miles an hour limits for cycling and walking. And that's what we should be doing. We should be introducing a whole area of the centre of the city that is car free except for disabled access. I'm absolutely sure of that. Any decent European city does that. I had everything thrown in my way to do that within 3 years, because these things, the legal processes do take a long time, but we seem to have stopped on that process. So my view is you cannot just simply do it by introducing more buses. You've got to be strong enough to deal with to introduce the stick as well as the carrot.
So is Marvin strong enough to do that? Or is it just impossible?
I tell you what, I think Marvin is coming from a different direction, that he recognises that many poorer people have old cars, generally old diesel cars. He doesn't want to punish them, neither do I. But I do believe they're more punished by living in poor quality air zones as a result of these policies than they are by having to change or reduce their use of the car. So, you know, we're coming from different directions. I put health first. He, in a way, is putting access to the car first. And, you know, who's right? I think I'm right, but let's see. But I think we've got to be much stronger in terms of control of the use of the car in the city. It's stolen children's play spaces. It has stolen community streets.
George, you're not going to do that all the time. People are so frustrated with the bus service. And what the...
No, because you need to free up the streets, Rangley, to create a decent bus service.
This protest on November the 24th has been organised by Frankie Langland. One of the things that Frankie says is Bristol City Council have announced, Jude, that their intention is to double the number of passengers that use Bristol's buses. To current passengers, this idea is laughable. The council's suggestion that flat rates will be introduced from the 11th of November, the reality of this has seen fare increases for many, as you said, at the time when the service has been actually reduced.
Yeah, I mean, of course you've got to...
So people are blowing a fuse out there,
but you've got to
use the buses.
But you've got to work with the bus
company. And you know what? This drives people into the car, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it does. But you've got to work with the bus company. You can't treat them as the enemy. You've got to treat them as a friend and work with them with the bigger policies rather than just knocking them because they haven't got enough drivers. And... yeah, I think, you know, the dreaded Brexit, which I'd not mentioned up till now, is going to be part of it. We are going to lose some drivers, and and there are less young people learning to drive, which actually is encouraging some ways, but it does mean there are probably less bus drivers available.
We could talk about Brexit now, if you wish, because it's all sort of supposed to have been all sorted out by now, but it's not. His name is Alexander Stubb. He is the former Finnish Prime Minister, and he's slated to be taking over from Donald Tusk next year as the President of the European Union.
Well, I think the best model of society is a combination of liberal democracy, social market economy, and fair globalization. We live in a world where goods flow freely, where services flow freely, and we have to make it justified. It's our model of society, and I think actually in the midst of the technological revolution, when we start having 3D printing, we start having drones moving goods around, I think it's quite silly to try to shut yourself off from the rest of the world. But we have to live with the situation with Brexit, and I think a lot of the politicians are trying to make the best out of a situation which everyone understands it's a total lose-lose proposition.
It sounds a little bit as if what they're actually trying to do is obstruct what people voted for in the referendum, and that surely is wrong.
No, not at all. No, not at all. I'm just trying to put a little bit of realism in the world that we live in nowadays. Look, here's an example. You are interviewing me from a studio in London on Sky News. I stand here.
No, I'm not. I'm in Brussels,
actually. About free movement. You're in Brussels. So we're both here in Brussels. But in any case, I mean, the bottom line is that being against the European Union is a little bit like being against the internet. You can do it, but I've always said it would be much smarter to try to influence the content of it. Having said that, I'm a pragmatic Finn. Let's try to find a solution in this very difficult situation. And I would personally like to see a future relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom, which is as close as possible.
Well, what have we done? I actually don't believe that it was particularly a vote against Europe. I think it was a vote against establishment politics, and which we've seen happening all over the world. I think it's been distorted by the money that was thrown at it, and it remains to be seen whether that was illegal or not. It's been distorted by outside interference, probably from Russia and elsewhere. And we didn't know what we were voting for. We now are we're closer to knowing whether we're going to get a deal or not. I think people should have the right to vote on the deal, and then they would, it would work either way. I don't mind which way it goes in a way. I just would like some clarity. At the moment, I feel that everybody loses.
Yeah, everybody's going to lose. It's going to be a almighty problem for families.
So those that voted for Brexit are a bunch of lemmings?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that they were lied to. I think that they were fed up with what they were being fed by politicians, and it was kick them in the what's it. And I don't think it was particularly about Europe. So let's see if it was. Let's give people a chance to vote on an actual deal that they understand.
Wasn't it a vote of no confidence in Brussels, basically?
Well, it's partly a vote of no confidence in Brussels. I think it was much more a vote of no confidence in our national politicians.
But, I mean, surely if you're saying we want out of Brexit, you're handing power to the national politicians. It's saying, well, maybe we don't like either of you, but we prefer Westminster to Brussels.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's obviously that flag waving, and one understands, you know, that nationalism kicks in to a certain extent. But I do believe, and I know, for instance, on issues such as the environment, we would not we would be miles behind if we were not part of that European project. I had the pleasure of taking part in the Paris COP. The fact that we were taking part with European cities, which played an important role, by the way, was absolutely tremendous. And Europe, the EU, had a really major input into the climate change agreement. To lose our say in all that seems really sad.
George, well, since you're here, Marvin Rees in his State of the City address was talking about the Bundred Report, which was pointing the finger at you, really, saying, well, hang on a minute, George didn't do a very good job with the budget. So let's just have a brief listen now to, it's about a minute or so, an extract from his State of the City speech, where really he was blaming you for the city's present ills.
Yeah, he was.
He said, even those senior officers who have raised concerns with me appear to have very little awareness of what a first-class local authority looks like. And Mr. Bundred went on to conclude, saying, I'm in no doubt that the sequence of events described in this report represents a collective failure of leadership within the council for which several people, including elected politicians, bear responsibility. Now, I would share with you that having a local authority that is competent is one of those unfairly balanced things in life. It's rarely noticed, and it doesn't fill people with joy and excitement when it's delivered. But it is certainly noticed, and people pay a heavy price when it's not, because the leaders of a place have no foundation from which to deliver. The 2018 report into the failed Northamptonshire Council said, never underestimate the importance of doing the boring well. Well, I'm delighted to be able to say tonight that in my Deputy Mayor, Craig Cheney, who has led on our council finances, we have someone who has become a master of doing their boring well.
So that really was a bit of a dig at you, George, wasn't it? And he's saying now, although we've had to make lots of cuts, finally we're back on the straight and narrow.
Well, it was incredibly dishonest. And I was sitting in the front row, so I was absolutely seething about that. I've left Marvin with a much stronger foundation than he could possibly have hoped for if it had been 4 years earlier. I left him with huge capital assets, built reserves, which actually I had people from, particularly from the Lib Dems, trying to get me to use. Anything that he's complaining about pales into insignificance with all that. He could not be doing what he's doing in terms of house building, in terms of what he's trying to do at Temple Quarter, unless I'd acquired all those capital assets. So I don't know. I just think it's a bit of a set-up job. When Marvin came in, he seemed intent on undoing anything that I did, you know, from my mayoral bicycle stand to green capital to reviewing 20 miles an hour, reviewing all the transport policies and residence parking. And it just was playing that dumb game that politicians play when they come into power. Let's pile all the blame on the previous administration so that we can take praise for anything that happens. I never did that. I never blamed the previous administration. I think it's a crass thing to do, and I asked Marvin to tell the truth.
Well, it's not just the local budget this week, it's also the national autumn budget, pre-Brexit budget. And rather than listen to the officials on this, I thought we'd have a listen to Kerry-Anne Mendoza. She's the editor of the Canary, which is based here in Bristol, and she's Bristolian, as you will tell from her voice. But it was an appalling decision by The Guardian and the National Union of Journalists to stop her talk, which was going to be taking place at The Guardian. She was going to be giving a fantastic lecture, which was an annual lecture, from her sort of left perspective, and they said no, you can't do it, but she did it somewhere else. But anyway, she had, I thought, a fascinating take on the budget this week too, and of course that wasn't published in The Guardian. It was on actually on Russia Today, on the Going Underground show, and that's the only place I managed to find her popping up apart from in her own publication. So let's have a listen now to Kerry-Anne Mendoza, Bristol editor of The Canary, and her take on this week's budget and the supposed end of austerity.
You know, it's the Jam Tomorrow budget that we've rewatched and re-listened to every year almost since austerity began. You know, we've got, they've got a few years in. I feel like there's a pressure on the government now to essentially pretend that this is all nearly done. You know, this is all actually necessary. And well done the British public for taking a hit so that we could balance the books. When what we all know is austerity is ideological. This is not a real thing. This is not a tightening of the belt to, you know, see you through a tough budgetary period. This is the systematic dismantling of the welfare state. This is a deliberate policy, the deliberate underfunding of public services and the welfare state in order to see it effectively collapse, to buckle, to then advocate the privatisation of those services. And we all knew this. It was never intended to balance the books or help people out of poverty. You look at the key thing, you know, what are the key crises at the moment? We've got the housing crisis, we've got a welfare crisis, we've got a prisons crisis. And which departments are getting cut? The very departments that should be leading the way on those things.
Housing community is down from 2.6 billion to 2.3, Ministry of Justice down 6.3 to 6. 8% cut in schools in real terms, 20,000 police gone. Why do you think it's not reflected? And I know this relates presumably to Claudia Jones's idea of what journalism should be. We're not hearing that in any of the post-budget commentary. We're hearing an idea about, is it over? Are they stealing Corbyn's clothes? This kind of debate.
To be honest, it's just beyond ridiculous now. I think several years into this, we thought, well, maybe, you know, they don't understand. You know, maybe if, you know, the work we can do as a left-wing media is to put forward these ideas, to really unpick these budgets and to supply that information almost back to the mainstream and so that they could kind of break out of this cycle. But what's really become clear over the last couple of years is that these people are apologists for this system. I do think at this point you can no longer say, well, you know, the government promised this but then it didn't deliver, so the poor media were just kind of hoodwinked. You know, you hoodwinked once, okay, hoodwinked every year for almost a decade, you've got to start wondering, you know, who's kidding who, because people are already working 2-3 jobs just to feed their kids. They're not going to come home from work and feel like, I know what I'm going to do now. I'm going to read a 106-page budget and calculate exactly what the impact is on me. So they rely on the media to break these things down for them. And all we have seen from the last few years is them convince the public that what they're experiencing isn't real. I mean, it's almost institutional gaslighting at this stage where people are saying, but I feel poorer. I am poorer. My rent's gone sky high. My wages have dropped. And that is incredibly disingenuous. And I think it's causing extreme distress. You know, we have people committing suicide. We have people dying because of this. It's not some abstract academic debate about the impact of austerity on people. It's real and tangible.
Well, just but as soon as the government started cutting taxes on the wealthy at the same time as saying there's no money for the poor, it's pretty clear it's an ideological project, isn't it? And we could discuss what they should have done in terms of deficit reduction in another time. But once you've cut taxes on the wealthy, then everybody else says, what the hell's going on?
George?
And inheritance tax. I want to be taxed when I die, heavily. It won't hurt. And it is, I think it is maintaining the difference between the rich and the poor in this country.
Jude?
I love that phrase that she put in there, institutional gaslighting. I think that's exactly what she's doing. And, I mean, not just she's doing, but she's hit the nail on the head. We are in that situation. And
I'll put a link up to that anyway on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks to our guest screen councillor for Ashley, Jude English, former independent mayor George Ferguson of Bristol, of course, and long-time member of Bristol Housing Action Movement Ben Ritchie. Join us after the news.
Radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.